Go. Good morning, everyone. Welcome along to this session. My name is Aidan Finn, and it's my pleasure to be presenting at TechEd for the first time. Today, I'm going to be talking to you, and please forgive the title, it's a bit wordy, from Demo to Reality, Best Practices for Deploying Windows Server 2012 or 2 Hyper-V. I like wordy titles. You may have seen that in some of the books I've written in the past. They're very descriptive. I am a Hyper-V MVP, which gives me a unique way of seeing what Microsoft are doing with Hyper-V. I get to work with the program managers of Hyper-V and some of the related technologies like storage, networking, and failover clustering. And I get to see how passionate these people are at the work they do. And I get to appreciate the breadth of the work they do. When you come to a TechEd, very often what you see is the highlight features. And I want to talk to you about how they justify some of those announcements that they make. So how do they hit those millions of IOPS from within a Hyper-V virtual machine? How do they say that this is going to change the way you work and make your career better and more enjoyable? There's a lot of stuff that they do to make that happen, and I want to explain how they do that. In my job, I'm a technical sales lead for a distributor of Microsoft and related technologies based in Dublin in Ireland. I blog on my own site on aidanfinn.com, and I'm the contributing editor for Microsoft Virtualization at the Petri IT Knowledge Base on petri.com. I've written a few books over the years, and I am on Twitter, where I'm a bit too chatty, as @Joe_Elway. So I'm focusing on Windows Server 2012 or 2 Hyper-V. I want to explain what you can do to get the most out of your existing investment or your pending investment in Microsoft's CloudOS. There's a lot there. So usually, I'm guilty of focusing on vNext or the brand new stuff, but 2012 or 2 is what we can use right now, and it's really, really good. And I hope you'll agree with me at the end of this session. I'm covering a lot of stuff. Time and time again, Microsoft have asked, "Am I going to hit this in 75 minutes?" In my rehearsals, yes. We'll see about the real thing. I'm covering a breadth of stuff. I'm tying it all together by explaining how Microsoft are making those big announcements, how they are doing those big demos, and the little stuff, well, not actually little, the lesser-known features, which have big, significant changes. I'm spanning virtual machines, networking, administration, failover clustering, and PowerShell. Who's using PowerShell? Hands up. Wow. You are a skewed audience because you come to TechEd. You get the message. When I do that question most of the time at events, it's a minority of people who put up their hands. So you guys understand what I'm going to be showing you with PowerShell today because I'm going to have a lot of PowerShell. The function of a hypervisor is to enable us to run virtual machines. We get the scale or flexibility and agility of virtual machines, software-defined compute, to use the new term that popped up this week. When I started working in virtualization, we had a couple of rules of thumb. You put 10 virtual machines onto a host. Didn't matter what the spec was. You put 10 virtual machines onto a host. And you only put like workloads into virtual machines. But with Windows Server 2012, Jeff Woolsey and some of the other senior people in Microsoft stood on a TechEd stage and said, "That's no longer the rule. Those ratios, gone. And you can take any workload. You can take your OLTP and run that in a Hyper-V virtual machine with up to 64 virtual CPUs and a terabyte of RAM." And Jeff repeated that message yesterday in one of the foundation sessions. So pretty much anything without a physical hardware peripheral dependency can run in a Hyper-V virtual machine. Now, this wasn't the result of some developer saying, "Let's change that from 4 virtual CPUs and 64 gigs of RAM and just increase it." Microsoft had to account for the physical hardware that Hyper-V or any other operating system or hypervisor would run on. When you take your typical host, which is a 2U server or a blade server, it has a pair of processors, and it has memory banks. And the motherboard is divided up into two NUMA nodes, non-uniform memory access. One socket or processor has a direct bus to half the memory DIMMs. The other processor has a direct memory bus to the other half of the memory DIMMs. You will have seen this in the instructions inside your server hardware for installing additional memory. When an operating system or a hypervisor is scheduling a process and assigning memory to that process, its most efficient path is to assign memory within the same NUMA node as the thread that's executing and is going to use that memory. However, if there's a shortage of memory within the NUMA node, the scheduler has no choice but to assign memory from another NUMA node. And it's spanning those NUMA nodes using a very inefficient back channel. So the peak performance of that process will drop and potentially will affect other processes running on that host. We refer to this as NUMA node spanning. Hyper-V implements something called guest-aware NUMA. And guest-aware NUMA is activated when we start a virtual machine. It's there by default. Hyper-V will present the physical architecture to the guest OS of the virtual machine, be it Windows or Linux, and it will allow the virtual machine to schedule processes in the guest OS or within the virtual machine and assign memory from within the virtual machine according to the physical architecture of the underlying hosts. So we get the best possible peak performance. The guest OS will, like a physical OS or a physical hypervisor, do best effort. Sometimes there won't be enough memory within that virtual NUMA node, and it will have to go to another virtual NUMA node, i.e. another physical NUMA node, to assign memory. And then we get that drop in peak performance. Guest NUMA is static. As I said earlier, Hyper-V presents that guest-aware NUMA to the guest OS at the time when the virtual machine boots up. It's not dynamic. So if we move the virtual machine from a large host that has big NUMA nodes with loads of memory to a smaller host that has smaller NUMA nodes with very little memory, it will not dynamically change. We will get something called splitting. This is where the virtual NUMA nodes span more than one physical NUMA node, and we lose that alignment and that efficiency that we normally get. And we get a drop in performance. NUMA spanning is a per-host setting, and it is enabled by default, and I personally have never seen it being disabled, but you may want to disable it in some scenarios. This setting prevents virtual machines from spanning NUMA nodes. As I said, it's per host, so it affects all virtual machines on that host. If you disable NUMA spanning, virtual machines will not be able to split. They will be forced to have virtual NUMA nodes that match the host. And you get consistent performance because you never get this spanning ever happening. So between reboots, no matter where the virtual machine is, you get consistent performance. On the bad side, if I start up that virtual machine and it doesn't have enough memory within the NUMA nodes and it needs to span, it will not start because it can't span. The host is preventing it. If I go back to the scenario of a virtual machine moving from a large host to a small host, we need to split the NUMA nodes. We can't because the destination host is preventing spanning. So we lose some agility if we disable NUMA spanning. NUMA is an optimization technique for assigning memory, or for selecting memory, I think would be a better phrase. Dynamic memory is another memory optimization technique that we have that we can electively turn on in a virtual machine. And that allows us to economize the assignment of memory to virtual machines. Virtual machines only get enough memory from the host to do what they need to do, and they give it back when they don't need it. If you enable dynamic memory in a Hyper-V virtual machine, you will lose guest-aware NUMA. The virtual machine will boot up non-aligned and with one virtual NUMA node that will split or span. So you have a choice. If I am building a very large virtual machine that will span NUMA nodes, I can decide if I want to span those NUMA nodes or not span those NUMA nodes. Do I want split or not? If I enable dynamic memory, I will get one NUMA node. It will span, it will split. I will lose peak performance for applications that will run in that virtual machine. Although, if I want economy of scale, if I want to efficiently assign memory on an on-demand basis, I will enable dynamic memory. But if I want peak performance, I will disable dynamic memory and I will configure static memory in my virtual machine. So if I am deploying that virtual machine with an OLTP workload with 64 virtual CPUs and a terabyte of RAM, I will do static RAM and not dynamic memory. So we'll have a quick demo. Flip over. There we go. So I'm running a Hyper-V cluster, and I'm using SMB3 storage to a scale-out file server using one of the JBOD solutions that you can find in the expo hall. I have a virtual machine called Numa that's running there, and I'm going to be running a script that's going to do some configurations and some queries. You'll see all the PowerShell commandlets that I'm running in this script. So run get VM host Numa node, and I can query the Numa architecture of my host. It's a 2U server with two processors. It's got 24 logical processors, so I've enabled hyper-threading on the processor. Each Numa node has 32 gigs of RAM. So I can create a nice big virtual machine with 24 virtual CPUs and 64 gigs of RAM, and it would consume all the resources on that host. I'll query my virtual machine that's called Numa, and I can see it's got 24 logical processors. It's got 8 gig of memory, potentially, but it's got dynamic memory enabled. I've got one Numa node that is not aligned. So I will not get peak performance out of this virtual machine. It will span Numa nodes inefficiently. I can change that. I'm going to configure the machine to have static RAM. So shut down the virtual machine, configure it with static RAM, shut it down, start it up, query it again. I've got dynamic memory disabled now, and I can see I have two virtual Numa nodes, and Numa aligned is set to true. So now my virtual machine will efficiently schedule processes and assign memory across those two Numa nodes on the physical host. And I will get the best peak performance for my application or service. We like speed. We like agility. And Microsoft has done a lot to enable this. We all work with production workloads, whether we're consultants, administrators, or operators, or whatever. And we face scenarios where we need to be able to diagnose performance issues and test upgrades. If we're in a change control environment, we need to test rollback plans. Do you want to really do that with a production service? Yes, but I don't want downtime. I need to maintain my SLA. So we have a feature in 2012 or 2 that allows us to live export a running virtual machine. Not only that, but we can live export a snapshot or a checkpoint, as it's currently called, of a virtual machine. So I can take a copy of my virtual machine as it is now, where it's having a problem. I can export it, and then I can import it as a clone of the original virtual machine on an isolated virtual network or VLAN, and perform my diagnostics, my testing, install those patches to see if it solves the problem with the actual service and the actual data. All basically a clone of the existing machine that's having the problem. I can take a checkpoint and I can export that. So I can take a virtual machine as it was 2 versions ago or 3 weeks ago, and I can export that as a merged copy of the virtual machine. No AVHDX files. It's a merged copy of it. And I can import that and bring up a clone of the virtual machine as it was 2 versions or 3 weeks ago. I think a demo shows this much better, so we'll flip over. I have a virtual machine here, and I'm going to run my script. Again, this is showing PowerShell how I can do this stuff, or with PowerShell, how I can automate this stuff and make the entire process predictable. My virtual machine is running. I'm not going to shut it down to do the export as I would have in the past. I export the virtual machine, and that creates a bunch of files and folders that I can then transport and import to create a clone of that virtual machine. But I'm not going to do that. Instead, I'm going to work with a checkpoint of that virtual machine. So I now have a checkpoint, and I'm going to transport that checkpoint and import it to create a new virtual machine, which we should see pop up in Hyper-V Manager any second now. There is my new virtual machine. And then I can use that to test my patches, do my diagnostics, hack the registry, test my upgrade plans, test my rollback plans. And when I've got an actual process that I know is going to work on the actual production system, I can do that cleanly in a scheduled maintenance window. So I've minimized my impact on the business And that is a very valuable feature. We are in the era of cloud computing. You have heard the word cloud this week so far several thousand times. There are many definitions of a cloud, but the industry accepted one comes from the American National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST. They have a PDF document that describes the five traits that they see as being essential in a cloud. And one of those traits is that any service, i.e. a virtual machine that's deployed, is measured. In other words, we're doing granular measurement of its resource consumption. And we can do that in Hyper-V using resource metering. Resource metering is enabled on a per virtual machine basis. The data that it gathers is stored with the virtual machine, so when the virtual machine moves, migrates, or whatever, the data moves with the virtual machine. And we can query that data using PowerShell. And by default, it's gathered on a one-hour interval. We can change that if we want. And with it, we get CPU utilization, memory utilization, average peak and minimum, or we get disk utilization, and we get, very interestingly, network utilization. And we can get some very granular stuff with the network utilization, not just that it's had so many megs in and out, but we can define specific network addresses. So we can say we don't care about LAN traffic, we do care about internet traffic. This is something, if you're a service provider, going to be very valuable. And don't think of service provider as being a public cloud. Some IT departments are service providers to internal customers, and they need to do cross-charging. It gives you, here is a way to do that cross-charging, the same way as you can do with something like Azure. Or, if you are a cost center IT department, you might use this for showback reporting and show the cost of providing services to individual departments or teams. All driven using PowerShell. We can enable it per VM. The first commandlet there is actually enabling it on all virtual machines running on a host called DemoHost 3. And we can change the reporting interval if we want. And then we use Measure VM to actually pull back the data. There's a few interesting ways of using this data. We might find the top three utilizers of a particular resource. So I'm showing one that's using a processor. We can get very interesting information about the network, as I said earlier, so we can define specific rules to measure traffic inbound or outbound on specific IP addresses. And then we can measure and dive deep into that network reporting. So I'm going to show you this now with a virtual machine. And I'm going to use this virtual machine called metering. And we can watch the memory on that virtual machine increase in a second. So run the script. I'm enabling metering using getVM. And I then specify the machine. And then I enable VM resource metering. Now I am utilizing memory in the virtual machine, and I'm doing a transfer into the virtual machine. That will use valuable resource. We can see the memory's gone up to 1,746 megs, and it's increasing a bit more. Then we should see a network copy happen after that. Now I can query the data, and we can see we use an average of 1,382 megahertz. We used a peak of 1,746 megs of RAM. My virtual machine has 60 gigs of storage, and there were 13 megs of inbound traffic. I can dive a bit deeper into that network traffic, and I can see exactly what that network traffic is. I haven't put in any specific ACLs for metering specific network addresses, but if I wanted, I could. It's a very valuable tool that's available to you to use with PowerShell. But this data can also be made available to other reporting systems. So you can generate billing, be it showback or cross-charge billing for your customers, internal or external. Yesterday, we heard that we could hit over 2 million IOPS from within a Hyper-V virtual machine. And there are now oodles of white papers from storage vendors out there proclaiming that they have hit 1 million 4K IOPS from within a Hyper-V virtual machine. That's pretty amazing. I've tried to do that myself. I've got one of these JBODs with SSDs and stuff like that, but I haven't come anywhere close. And you won't either, unless you do the right hacks. So how did they do it? Well, there's a few things. First is, in Windows Server 2012, we got VMBus Multichannel, or Hyper-V Storage NUMA I.O. And this allows the virtual SCSI adapter to send parallel interrupts to multiple processors within your virtual machine instead of being capped by the processing capability of a single virtual processor. Now, this is not something you're going to turn on willy-nilly. This is something that will consume more processor and consume more RAM in your virtual machines. I have never encountered a scenario in the real world where I've needed to do this, but if you do want to do one of those stress test type things to test your storage, this is something you would want to know about. We can add more channels to increase the IOPS capability of our virtual machine. So a virtual machine that has one virtual processor, has one channel, and has a maximum of one channel. Whereas if we have a virtual machine that has 64 virtual CPUs, by default it will have four channels, and we can increase that up to 16. And you would do that by first looking in Device Manager and getting the device ID and the instance ID of your SCSI adapter within the guest OS of the virtual machine, and then go to the registry and edit that at HKEY local machine system current control set enum VMBus device ID instance ID / device parameters store channel channel count. It's a long path. You can download the slides tomorrow, or you can take photos for now. Then, what do they do? Well, in one of the white papers, they described it very well. They created a virtual machine that had 16 virtual CPUs and one NUMA node. They configured one virtual SCSI controller, and that virtual SCSI controller had 16 virtual hard disks of fixed type, each that were 127 gigs in size. They increased that storage channel setting to the max for a virtual machine with 16 virtual CPUs, which is 4. And they stored all the virtual machine files on flash storage, obviously. They're not going to be doing this with spinning disks. And they connected to it using SMB3, so they had SMB multi-channel, and they had SMB direct, leveraging remote direct memory access, or RDMA. Low latency, low impact on the processor. That was all configured in a scale-out file server. And then they disabled a service within Hyper-V called the I.O. balancer. Most people haven't heard of the I.O. balancer. This provides virtual machines with a fair shot at the storage I.O. or the network I.O. underneath the virtual machines. Disabling that, generally considered a bad idea. But what it does is it measures and does fair balance. If you're a Star Trek physicist, you'll know the Heisenberg principle tells you that if you measure something, you change it. So they disabled that. And then within the virtual machine, they ran Iometer. And they stress tested with 16 threads hitting the 16 virtual hard disks in parallel, and they hit 1 million IOPS. And as you saw yesterday, Microsoft are now hitting over 2 million IOPS. So that's incredible throughput from within a virtual machine. And that's how they're able to stand on that stage and do that demo. If you are in a bigger environment, you will need to enable delegation of administration. Not everyone should be an administrator of your Hyper-V hosts. However, some people should have delegated rights for a subset of virtual machines or a subset of hosts. The real and the best solution for doing delegation administration is System Center. And going forward, in a very large environment with self-service, Windows Azure Pack. Those are the best solutions, but there are a few things you can do in Hyper-V if you're a small to medium-sized shop. You can use a Hyper-V Administrators group. It's a local group on all of your hosts. And you can populate that with your domain groups that contain all of your people that you want to grant Hyper-V administration rights to on your host, without giving them full administrator rights. But they will also need the permission to connect to the virtual machines using the Connect tool that you use in Hyper-V Manager, or you can run directly as vmconnect.exe. And we can do that using PowerShell, so we specify the virtual machine we want to grant rights to and the user or group that we want to grant those rights to. And then you can check your access and you can revoke your access using grant vmconnect access, get vmconnect access, and revoke vmconnect access. Now we're moving now into the world of administration, which is where we spend most of our time. When I first worked with Hyper-V, I've been working with Hyper-V since it was a beta for Windows Server 2008. And I worked in the hosting industry. And I had lots of virtual machines from lots of tenants in lots of isolated VLANs. These days we would try to use software-defined networking for scalability and self-service. But I had stuff to do for my tenants. We provided engineering services. I needed to be able to log into virtual machines and get files into virtual machines. And you know what? We ended up creating processes to do that. It was painful. We weren't able to copy and paste product keys into the Connect window. Simple things like that. A lot of things that you felt like you had to work around Hyper-V. So with 2012 and 2012 R2, Microsoft shaved the corners of administration. And they made Hyper-V an easier tool to use. And one of the big ones, and this got a round of applause at TechEd North America last year, was enhanced session mode. And this is where the VM Connect tool was upgraded. And using remote FX tunneled through the VM bus into... Using remote FX tunneled through the VM bus into the integration components or services of the virtual machine, we can get redirection of devices. So we can redirect our USB devices, our local drives on our PCs, our printers. We can log into the guest OS of the virtual machine using smart cards so we get better security and compliance. We get display configuration so we can use multiple monitors. We can set custom screen resolutions on a per session basis. And we can use the clipboard. We can copy and paste that product key from the volume license service center into the virtual machine, no longer having to use that awful little type clipboard text thing. And we can copy and paste files to and from the virtual machine. Now, it's important to note you do not need to enable the remote desktop services role within the guest OS. There's a big misconception out there that you have to do that. You do not need remote desktop services licensing either. This is using the integration components and the remote FX protocol. The user must have VM Connect permissions, which we covered a couple of slides ago, and they must have rights within the guest OS to sign in. So they either must be a member of remote desktop users or local administrators. Enhanced session mode must be enabled on the host. It is enabled by default on Windows 8.1 client Hyper-V, but it is disabled by default on Windows Server 2012 or 2. And that's done for security by default reasons. Not all organizations want their Hyper-V administrators copying and pasting files out of their tenants' virtual machines. That could be seen as a security risk. So this is something that you can turn on if you need it. It has a requirement of the guest OS. It must be current. So Windows 8.1, Windows Server 2012 or 2, and going forward, the VNex products. Enhanced session mode is a cool feature. If I had had it when I worked in the hosting business, it would have saved me a countless hours every year and would have made me faster at my job as well. So what I'm going to do is show you how I would connect into a virtual machine in the past. So enhanced session mode is disabled on my hosts. We've queried that there. And now I'm going to connect into the virtual machine using VM Connect and press Control Alt Delete. Log in and remember my password. There we go. And you know what? Let's get some text. There's this great article here by the Virtual PC Guy, Ben Armstrong, talking about some new announcements from Microsoft, and I need to put that into my virtual machine for some reason. So we'll minimize that, open up Notepad, and Control V, nothing. No copy paste. What's wrong? Well, what I'd have to do is clipboard, type clipboard text, and wait. And it would go ahead and type. And that was yucky. It's like a ghost is doing the typing for you. You can't copy paste files or anything like that. So it's not. It's okay for a product key, but nothing more than that. So what I'm going to do now is enable enhanced session mode. So we can see enhanced session mode is now set to true. Connect to the virtual machine, and my experience change. So that little dialog there is the same dialog you get with an RDP connection or remote FX connection when you're logging into a remote server to administer it. And that allows you to configure your device redirection, your screen resolution, multiple monitors, and all that stuff. Sign in, I have to sign in. The previous version of connecting into a virtual machine, I could inherit the session of the previous logged in person. It's like KVM. I'm being forced to sign in now. So I need to have administrator rights or remote desktop rights on this server. I can also use a smart card to sign in. So we can increase our security again. Now, I'm in a scenario where I need to be able to get a Windows update file out or log out of the host or of the virtual machine and open it up on my PC to do some diagnostics, and I've copied and pasted the file out of the virtual machine with no fuss. I don't need to burn anything to an ISO and stick it into a VMM library, mount the ISO into the virtual machine, copy the file out and run it, and then remove the ISO to make sure no one misuses the licensing. Or worse, log into the virtual machine of the tenant, open up Internet Explorer and start browsing the internet. I hope no one's doing that. If you're browsing from your servers, you deserve to get malware. So, that is enhanced session mode. Windows Server Data Center Edition. Love it. Why? Because it makes my licensing easy. I count the number of hosts I've got, because Windows Server Data Center Edition gives me unlimited installation rights of Windows Server on a licensed host. So I can have an infinite number of Windows Server virtual machines on any host that's correctly licensed for Windows Server Data Center Edition. Challenge with that is activating those virtual machines. If I am in an environment that has isolated tenant networks, so I've got test networks, I've got development networks, I've got a hosting environment, and I'm using VLAN isolation or software-defined networking to isolate my tenants, I will not be able to implement a KMS to activate those virtual machines. I'll have to activate them directly off the internet from the Microsoft Clearinghouse. That means I've introduced a manual step into my virtual machine deployment. And I've gotten rid of agility and flexibility, and I've gotten rid of self-service, one of those necessary traits in a cloud. With Windows Server 2012 R2 Data Center Edition, if I activate that host, when I deploy a virtual machine that's running Windows Server 2012 R2 Essentials, Standard, or Data Center, I can have that guest OS automatically inherit the activation from the host and be activated. So I get rid of the need to activate those guest OSs. The process is pretty simple. We deploy Windows Server 2012 R2 Data Center hosts. We activate them, probably using KMS. Then we deploy a virtual machine that we're going to use as a template, running Windows Server 2012 R2, Essential, Standard, or Data Center. And we get the AVMA key, Automatic Virtual Machine Activation Key, from TechNet. It's a single key that you will download from there. And you use SLManager/IPK to install that AVMA key. Then create your template from the virtual machine and deploy it. When you deploy it onto that activated 2012 R2 data center host, the guest OS will automatically activate. Alternatively, if you have existing templates in your VMM library, you might use that key in the auto-unattend XML file in your deployments and simplify your deployment process. Now, I've shown you one way to get files into virtual machine, but maybe you have disabled enhanced session mode for security reasons, and you need another way to get big files into your virtual machines. Example of that was, most of my tenants had SQL Server in their virtual machines. We had to install service packs. We got SQL Server on an ISO from the Microsoft Volume Licensing Service Center, but we didn't get the SQL service packs in ISO form. So we had to burn them to ISO, put them in the VMM library, and mount them. There's an easier way to do things in 2012 R2. And we can use the integration services of Hyper-V to copy that file, even without any network connection, into the guest OS. It's a very nice process. We activate the guest service interface. This integration service is off by default. And then we can copy the file into the virtual machine and then probably disable the guest service interface integration service. We can have a look at that in action. Hey, Windows updates. Thank you. So, close that, close that. Once again, PowerShell, gonna make my life easy. Start the demo. Let's take that text from Ben's article, and we'll copy it into a notepad file that I have open here on my host. I shouldn't be doing this sort of work on my host. I should be doing this on my PC and using Remote Server Administration Toolkit to do all my work. Close that. Enable the integration service. copy the file into the VM, disable the integration service. Now let's log into the virtual machine, sign in, and open up Explorer. The file should be sitting here on the C drive. There's my file. And there's the file with the text we just pasted in. So if I need to get installers in there, upgrades, whatever, I can get that into my virtual machine without network access. I'm doing this through the hypervisor. Now, I had one of these brainwave type things that, you know, I should try to avoid. And I thought, you know what? We could use this. We could do stuff the same way as Azure kind of does. What I could do is I could create some sort of service or schedule task that's going to run in all my tenants' virtual machines. And I could use that to run during a maintenance window and to check for the presence of installers in a particular folder. And then I could use out-of-band file copy to transfer those installers into my virtual machines, set up on a scheduled basis. So they go in there, and they sit there, and they wait for the scheduled task to run in the guest OS. It might be an upgrade to the integration components for Hyper-V. It might be a monitoring agent upgrade. It might be an antivirus upgrade, those sort of things. They drop in there, the task runs, it runs the installer, and stores the result of the install in the registry, the particular part of the registry where from the Hyper-V host I can run another scheduled task and query that result using key value pairs. Look for some posts by a guy called John Howard from the Hyper-V team, and you'll learn all about key value pairs and querying the registry of your virtual machines. I think that would be a nice way to do those upgrades of your virtual machines without network access. Simplify the whole process. When I started working in virtualization way back when, I was working with the beta of Virtual PC and Virtual Server, the previous generation of Microsoft virtualization products. And there was a KB article out there, and it was around for years and years and years, that said, if you will deploy virtual domain controllers, you basically have to treat them as like they were physical machines. You can't restore them from a virtual machine backup. You can't restore them from a save state. You can't restore them from a pause state if they've been sitting there a long time. You can't restore them from a checkpoint or a snapshot. And the reason is, you could do something really bad if that virtual machine or that virtual domain controller traveled in time. It could cause something called a USN rollback. If you're a directory services person, at this point you're going, no, I can't have that. So Microsoft changed that with Windows Server 2012. There were changes in Hyper-V and Active Directory Services that brought in something called Virtual Machine Generation ID, or VM Generation ID. When we power up a virtual domain controller running Windows Server 2012 or later on Hyper-V 2012 or later, the virtual domain controller will check to see if it has traveled in time, a very Doctor Who experience. And if it has been restored from a checkpoint or a snapshot or restored from backup or whatever, the virtual domain controller won't start producing RIDs. It won't try to replicate stale user accounts to the rest of the forest. It will wait until it's been replicated too and then start behaving normally after that. Now, a side effect of VM generation ID is we are now able to clone additional domain controllers in a domain. I'm not talking about the PDC emulator, I mean additional domain controllers beyond the PDC emulator. So if you're running a forest with Windows 2003 or later, with the AD schema at V56 or later, and your PDC emulator is running Windows Server 2012 or later, and you're running Hyper-V, Windows 8 or Windows Server 2012 or later, you can create a domain controller, a template, running Windows Server 2012 or later. Make sure there's no mounted ISOs or anything like that in the virtual machine, and log into that virtual machine as a domain admin and run PowerShell with elevated rights. Add that virtual domain controller in Active Directory to a group called Clonable Domain Controllers. Then within the guest OS, you're going to run two PowerShell commandlets. Get ADDC cloning excluded application list will query the guest OS to see if there are any banned roles or services installed within the guest OS. A new ADDC clone config file will create an XML file that you can use to customize the deployment of your additional domain controllers. You can then shut down this virtual machine, export it, and that export is now your template for creating new domain controllers in your domain. So you can securely transport those files on a USB drive with BitLocker encryption out to your branch office, power it up, and you get yourself a new domain controller. No need to do all the DC promo process out there. Make sure when you import the virtual machine that you use create new unique ID so it gets a new unique GUID. So if the virtual machine does end up being on the same host as the original, you don't have any issues. Networking is one of the pillars, along with storage, of virtualization. Without networking, what's the point? And Microsoft have made a huge amount of investment in Windows Server 2012, 2012 R2, and as you may have heard yesterday, in vNext. There are lots of things in there about uptime and performance. Uptime is critical to us. We need high levels of SLA, whether we're service providers for internal customers or external customers. Nobody likes getting screamed at by the boss or the customer. Failover clustering added a feature called protected networks, where it's working hand in hand with Hyper-V. And this is enabled by default on each virtual NIC in your Hyper-V virtual machines. You'll see a little checkbox there in the advanced settings of your virtual NICs. It's enabled by default, and failover clustering will monitor the link status, the physical link status of your virtual machines. So if the NICs that your virtual switch are connected to go offline, and your virtual switch now has no route to the physical LAN, failover clustering will intervene. After about, it takes about up to a minute to intervene. It may be quicker. But what it will do is it will live migrate that virtual machine to another host in the cluster that has the same logical network connection and is functioning. That's important, because there's no point in live migrating it to a host that isn't connected to the LAN as well. I said a minute, up to a minute. That's going to be quicker than you'll probably respond to the issue. So at first, a minute may sound like a long time. But when you think about the alert coming in, somebody logging in, and then making a decision, let's get the virtual machines off of there, this is going to be quicker than you will. And it's also accounting for transitory issues. We don't want to be creating workloads on our networks. And it is just a transitory issue. And if you were attending some of the sessions yesterday, you will have heard how failover clustering in vNext will be dealing with those transitory issues. Software-defined networking, or SDN, is another one of those buzz phrases out there right now. Software-defined everything seems to be the mantra for this week if you're attending the server sessions. It increases flexibility, enables self-service. It simplifies things for administrators by putting the work back into the tenant. It speeds up deployments for tenants so they don't have to wait on IT to deploy VLANs and stuff. This is all great, but we still need security. What if we have a security policy within the corporation that says you will only configure Windows Firewall to allow the necessary ports? But if you're creating a self-service environment, you're stepping away from ownership of the guest OS and you're putting that into the hands of your developers and your testers and your branch administrators and all this stuff. And those guys may not comply with policy. So we can take that back. And we have a feature in Windows Server 2012 called port ACLs. Now, it was a bit limited in Windows Server 2012. What it allowed us to do was to create firewall rules that were implemented and applied by the virtual switch, not the guest OS. So we're taking control back from the tenant administrator, and we're applying this as Hyper-V administrators. We can apply these rules. We can measure traffic. We can block traffic. We can allow traffic. We can create nested rules, one generic one, like you would in a typical firewall, and then our higher priority rules that override that in specific scenarios. The problem with it was it only blocked or allowed or measured for specific protocols or IP addresses. It did not, actually IP addresses, sorry, or MAC addresses. It didn't even do protocols. It was an all or nothing. We allow traffic from this network. We don't allow traffic from this network. We allow traffic from this to this IP address. We don't allow traffic to this IP address. In Windows Server 2012 R2, we got extended port ACLs, where we now could do protocols. So we can specify TCP, UDP, or a numeric protocol number. We can specify port numbers, and we can also do stateful inspection. So now we get real firewalling that we can implement within the virtual switch. This is one of these features that almost nobody knows about, and I think it's a fantastic one because it is PowerShell, which makes it something that you can automate, and you can make available via self-service through System Center. So I have a virtual machine that is running a web server. And my company policy says If you have a server running on the company network, that server must only allow necessary inbound ports. And the tenant has deployed this virtual machine, it's running a web server, and they've disabled the Windows firewall. And they're allowing everything in, and they've become a security risk in the eyes of our network administrators. So I can see I've got a ping going there. Internet Explorer is browsing the site, no problem. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to run a rule here that's going to block all inbound traffic to that virtual machine. Now my pings will fail. Internet Explorer is no longer able to browse that site. So we have one rule. Action is deny. Direction is inbound. Wait is one. It's a generic rule. Block everything to that virtual machine. Applied by the virtual switch. The tenant can do whatever they want with Windows Firewall. They can't override me. I'm filtering at the virtual switch. And these rules will travel with the virtual machine to every host. Because if you don't know, the switch port in the virtual switch is effectively a property of the NIC of the virtual machine. So anything you do to that virtual switch port moves with the virtual machine when the virtual machine moves. I've now created a second rule where I'm allowing inbound port 80 on TCP, and it's got a weight of 10. So it overrides the weight of one rule for this specific scenario. Now we can browse the site, and my pings are still being blocked. So I've applied my security policy. The tenant administrator just has to live with it. They're now compliant, whether they like it or not. We can also do stateful inspection if you want. Basically, stateful inspection is I'll allow a response if we first transmitted and communicated with them. So we can do that using the PowerShell commandlets as well. I've already talked about big virtual machines. We can have virtual machines with up to 64 virtual CPUs and a terabyte of RAM. Odds are those virtual machines are going to be network intensive. They need a lot of inbound data, a lot of bandwidth. And you go and invest in your 10 gig or faster networking, and then you start pushing data into that virtual machine, and you get disappointed because you're getting somewhere between 2.5 gigs and 6 gigs per second. And you're wondering why. Well, on Windows Server 2012, Microsoft fixed that for physical servers. We got receive-side scaling and virtual machine queuing. Receive-side scaling allows the NIC to have multiple queues for inbound packets and to send interrupts to more than just Core 0. By default, without receive-side scaling, Core 0 is responsible for handling the interrupts of all inbound traffic, and your bandwidth is limited by the processing capability of Core 0. The same thing happens within a virtual machine. When packets arrive in onto the physical NIC, VMQ will allow the host processor to handle the packets, and the virtual switch is able to handle more throughput. But then the packet is dropped onto the virtual NIC in the virtual machine, and that has to send an interrupt to the virtual processors in the guest OS. By default, handled by processor 0. So now we're back to that bottleneck again. So we can push in or attempt to push in 10 gigs or faster networking into that virtual machine, but we will be limited by the processing capability of Core 0. So what we can do now with Windows Server 2012 or 2 is we can enable virtual receive-side scaling. So you'll edit the properties, the advanced properties of the NIC in the guest OS, and configure and enable receive-side scaling in there. You'll set it from false to true. And now you can max out your bandwidth into that virtual machine, so you can get some serious throughput. So back to the demos. And what I'm going to do here is, and I have to shout out to my friend Didier Van Hoy. He's a fellow Hyper-V MVP. He helped me configure the stress test in these demos. So thank you, Didier. He's back in Belgium and will probably watch this session tomorrow. I'm stress testing using a tool called NTTTCP.exe, and I'm pushing through as much traffic as I can from my host to a virtual machine that does not have virtual receive-side scaling enabled. And I'm going to push through 10 seconds of data. I can see in Perfmon how much traffic I'm getting through to that virtual machine. And I got a throughput rate of 853 megs per second. That's pretty disappointing for my networking. I've got really nice networking in my lab. 10 gig iWarp networking, so I've got RDMA and all that good stuff, which is great for live migration. So what I'm going to do now is enable the RSS, run the stress test again, and see what the results are like. And that's a massive difference. I've more than doubled my throughput into that virtual machine. And we'll see what the throughput rate is at the end of the 10 seconds. So with a flick of a switch, one PowerShell commandlet, or log in and go to network connect settings in the virtual machine, and I can see that I've gone from 840 megs per second to 1,914 megs per second by flicking a switch and using those additional processors in my guest OS and taking advantage of things like guest aware NUMA and physical NUMA awareness. So I get serious throughput and optimization of the processing of the interrupts as they come into the virtual machine. That's a good one if you are investing in that high capacity networking and doing that converged networking stuff with QoS as well. Failover clustering is the feature in Windows Server that gives us high availability. And we typically implement it at the physical layer, and we underuse it at the guest OS layer. Security for our hosts is critical. So I deal a lot with one of the brands that's in the expo hall, and we sell their cluster-in-a-box solution. And one of our better customers is deploying those cluster-in-a-box solutions in pop-up branch offices. And these branch offices may not have physical security. So this could be a military solution where they're deploying Hyper-V clusters into forward operating bases and they're worried, obviously, about physical security when they retreat or whatever. Sometimes a thermite grenade may not actually melt the disks and you want some other solution to protect your data. Maybe you're deploying something into colo hosting and you're a bit worried about the operators. You're not sure about them. You'd like to encrypt your data. Microsoft's encrypting solution is BitLocker. And BitLocker is a feature of Windows Server that allows you to encrypt your disks fully. So we've been able to do this for a while with Windows Server 2008 or 2, where we can encrypt the local data drives of our hosts. Turn it on, encrypt all your virtual machines on your non-clustered hosts. In Windows Server 2012 and later, we can encrypt our cluster shared volumes. So those highly available active-active volumes that we use with traditional block storage. We can encrypt those and secure the virtual machine files that are on there. So if we do have our physical security compromised, if someone takes those disks, they can't do anything with them. It's just random AES encrypted garbage. Requirements for this are you need Windows Server 2012 domain controllers, Windows Server 2012 or higher clustered hosts, your CSVs must be formatted with NTFS, not REFIS or Resilient File System. You can encrypt your CSV before you add it to the cluster or after you add it to the cluster. I'll show you the more complicated way of encrypting it after the cluster shared volume is added to the cluster. There is an impact in performance, but it is minimal. So if you need peak performance, you won't be using this, but those are typically data center workloads that are in physically secure locations. Lighter workloads, where you're not worried about peak performance, you will implement this if physical security is at risk of being compromised. You'll enable the BitLocker feature on each of your nodes in your cluster. Then you'll suspend the CSV. Obviously, you shut down your virtual machines before you suspend your CSV. Otherwise, bad things happen. Then you'll create a secure string and use that secure string to enable BitLocker on the CSV of choice. You always should protect the BitLocker recovery password because you need to be able to decrypt the volume. So we get that recovery password and we back it up. Then we need to grant the cluster permission to the CSV. And that's done by assigning permission to the cluster name object, that computer account that the cluster uses as its ID. So we query for that, then we get granted permission, and then we can resume the CSV operation and start up our virtual machines again. And our volume will be encrypted. And all the virtual machines on there will be encrypted. So if we lose the storage, we're good. But if you are working one of those forward operating bases for the military, it wouldn't be a bad idea to leave a thermite grenade at the top of the rack before you abandon the place. So, another thing we like to do with a clustering is schedule tasks. And we might need to schedule tasks to run on all our hosts at the same time, on a particular host that's hosting a virtual machine. Maybe we have a dodgy virtual machine we need to reboot on a regular basis. Or maybe we want to do it on any particular random node. And we can do that using cluster schedule tasks. This is a feature completely managed using PowerShell. And it will show up, the task will appear in Task Manager, but don't manage it there, use PowerShell. The PowerShell commandlets are all here. In this example, I create an action. This is the thing I'm going to do. I create a trigger. This is the time I want to do that thing. And then I will register cluster schedule task to register the trigger to run, or the action to run at the time of the trigger. And I can define my task to run on any node, a resource-specific node, or all nodes at the same time. And then I can query the status of my cluster schedule task using get cluster schedule task. So if we look at that, what I'm going to do is run those commandlets, and I'm going to schedule Notepad to run on all my nodes at the same time. Now, you're not going to see Notepad running because it's running as a system task, but I'm going to query for its existence using PowerShell and PowerShell remoting. So I'm going to create a trigger to run my job in 15 seconds. So create that, create a cluster schedule task, and in 15 seconds time, Notepad will be running on all the nodes in my Hyper-V cluster. So I'm querying every 5 seconds using PowerShell sleep command to see if it's running. So far, no. Next one maybe, or the one after that. There we go, Notepad is running. There it is on demo host 1, and here it is on demo host 2. So now I can take control of these scheduled tasks and run them the way I want them across my cluster. Not all virtual machines are made equal. Some virtual machines are way more important than others. And we can reflect that using virtual machine priority in failover clustering. We can model application dependencies, and we can change the way we migrate virtual machines when we pause a host for a maintenance operation. There are four priorities. I'm only showing you three here. The four are high, which has a numeric value of 3,000. Medium, which is the default for any virtual machine, that has a numeric value of 2,000. And low, which has a numeric value of 1,000. There's also one called no auto start. It's a very low priority virtual machine, and when you fail that over, it won't start up and consume resources. We can use this priority in a number of ways. The first is we prioritize the startup of virtual machines when a host fails. The virtual machines will fail over, and we can prioritize their startup order. Maybe virtual domain controllers should start up before SQL servers, because the SQL servers need to authenticate against domain controllers. Maybe we start up our web servers after our SQL servers, because it's pointless then presenting services if there's no data to present. And we can use our priorities in that method. We can also prioritize virtual machines when we have memory shortages in our cluster. So we've had host failures, virtual machines have failed over, but we don't have enough memory for all the virtual machines. A high priority virtual machine will be granted memory ahead of a low priority virtual machine. So low priority virtual machines will actually be kept offline, so those high priority virtual machines can come online. We can also use priority to define how we migrate virtual machines when we pause a host, because we can pause a host since 2012 for maintenance windows. And also in 2012 or 2, we'll use this drain functionality when we shut down a host. It'll happen automatically for you. So if you worked with Windows Server 2008 Hyper-V, you will have heard of quick migration. And basically, we hated it. It was the thing that our competitors would always point at and go, you don't have live migration. And then in 2008 or 2, we got live migration. Quick migration, what it does is it saves the state of the virtual machine, its memory and processor stack, to disk, fails over the virtual machine, because it's now offline, and reads back in the state to start the virtual machine up. And the time that migration took depended on the amount of memory you had and the speed of your storage. And that could be, for a small virtual machine, it could be 4 seconds, could be 8 seconds, could be a minute. But maybe you want to be able to use quick migration for some low priority virtual machines because you want to prioritize your limited live migration bandwidth for high and medium priority virtual machines. And that's what Microsoft did by default in Windows Server 2012. And this was a surprise to some of us who tested out this priority stuff, paused the node, expected to see everything use my live migration to the other nodes in the cluster, and we saw our low priority virtual machines going to the save state, fail over and start up again. And we went, what? What's this? And we emailed the program managers in the clustering group, and they said, well, we've got customers who need this. But don't worry, because in 2012, you can configure a value called move type threshold. And this actually defines which virtual machines will use live migrations. So in Windows Server 2012, this was set to 2,000 and higher. So it had a value of 2,000. Medium priority and high priority virtual machines use live migration. Low priority is quick. Then they changed it in Windows Server 2012 or 2 based on the feedback we gave them. We said everything should be live migration by default. Let us opt in to quick migration. So now move type threshold in 2012 or 2 is set to 1,000. So everything uses live migration, but you can raise the value if you want to use quick migration. And we also have the ability to set specific migration types for virtual machines. So I can say this virtual machine must always use quick migration. Everything else can use live migration. We can override the move type threshold for individual virtual machines using the default move type value of the virtual machine cluster resource. So -1 is inherit the cluster's move type threshold, 1 is use quick migration, and 4 is use live migration. And we can see what this looks like. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to be working with my cluster. Let's bring up Failover Cluster Manager. And let's have a look at the priority types. You're not seeing what I'm doing. Don't worry, I haven't done anything interesting yet. I'm just relaying out Failover Cluster Manager. And run my script. And all my virtual machines currently are set to medium, which you can see on the right-hand side. And in the left-hand side, in the PowerShell, I'm querying that, and you can see they have a numeric value of 2,000. I'm going to use PowerShell to quickly modify a bunch of those to give them a low priority of 1,000. And now I'm going to do the same thing with another few virtual machines and give them a priority of 3,000 or high. Now I'm going to pause demo host 1. So we'll see what happens in 2012 or 2 to default configuration. Anyone here at Ben Armstrong's session yesterday? If you were, yeah, a few of you. You will have heard him talk about hardware-assisted live migration, and this is where we can use the features of SMB3, so SMB multi-channel, to span multiple channels across multiple NICs, so we can aggregate our bandwidth for live migration. And we can also use SMB Direct, or Remote Direct Memory Access, so we can get low latency, low processor impact live migration. So I'm going to be pushing through 20 gigabits per second live migration across my converged networks on my hosts. I'm not using any expensive third-party peripherals. I'm using the features of Windows Server to aggregate my NICs on my hosts and apply QoS so I can control the bandwidth utilization with bursts. No need to spend 18 grand per virtual appliance device to do that sort of thing. Pause my hosts, and I'm going to have 10 virtual machines live migrating and the others queuing up to live migrate. And this should be over pretty quick. So all my virtual machines are now over on demo host 2. Now I'm going to raise the move type threshold. I'm going to move it from the default of 1,000 to 2,000. Basically, what that means is virtual machines with a 1,000 value will now use quick migration. So change that. Now I'm going to resume host 1 with failback, so it's going to trigger a live migration, or a migration, should I say. Because medium and high are going to use live migration, low are saving state, failover, and then read state back again. They're doing quick migration. There may be specific virtual machines in there where I could override that and say they should use live migration if I want. And that is virtual machine priority and how we can use it to configure and optimize the drain of our hosts. I said earlier that we implement failover clustering typically on our hosts to get infrastructure high availability. And that's great for those of us running central IT, who are running the fabric, those so-called fabric administrators. But that's pretty much useless for our services if they don't have high availability. So we need to implement some sort of high availability within our virtual machines, so when a host goes offline, the services that are running on that host also continue to run. So the way we do that is we use features like failover clustering, network load balancing, or application development, so cloud-style development, to make sure we have multiple virtual machines in each tier of each service. So if a host goes offline, yes, the virtual machines on there go offline and fail over and start up within a minute or so, but while they're offline, other parts of the service keep the service online. So this could be a load balance set of web servers. We have web servers running on host 1 and host 2, and they're load balanced. And if host 1 goes offline, the virtual machine on host 2 keeps the service online. But what if someone live migrates that virtual machine from host 2 to host 1? Both our web servers are there. Host 1 goes offline. The farm goes offline. Pretty useless. This is why we want anti-affinity. This is a feature that is in failover clustering, but is not obvious because you don't see it being blogged about very much. It is not in the GUI. And it is purely done using some pretty obscure PowerShell. You won't even see a nice friendly PowerShell commandlet for this one. It's very obscure. So what we can do with anti-affinity is configure virtual machines to effectively repel each other. So if I have a pair of load-balanced virtual machines, I can make sure the clustering always puts them on different hosts on a best effort basis, assuming there's host capacity available. We do that using PowerShell, using something called a specialized string collection. Hands up if you've heard of that before. There's a couple of you who are PowerShell gurus, and well done. We can define one of these, and then I can modify the cluster group of my virtual machines, and there's a property there called anti-affinity class names, and I will specify basically my anti-affinity collection that I want that virtual machine to join. So I have two virtual machines in this example, VMO1 and VMO2. They'll both be in the same specialized string, or both specify the same specialized string collection, which means when failover clustering is placing or moving those virtual machines, it will do its best to make sure they're on different hosts. I can show you that in a bit of a mock-up demo. So I'm going to have to trigger a live migration to make this work. So anti-affinity, run PowerShell. So first, I'm going to create my specialized string collection, and I'm going to define a service called myHA service. And then I'm going to edit the cluster groups of my virtual machines and modify the anti-affinity class names property and specify the variable that I use to store that new specialized string collection. And now I'm going to trigger, well, I'll query that and see both my virtual machines are in the same anti-affinity collection now. And now I'm going to trigger the cluster to actually have to move one or both of these virtual machines. I'm going to pause one of my hosts and watch Affinity 1 is now live migrating and is now on demo host 2 after it was on demo host 1. And a cluster from now on will keep Affinity 1 and Affinity 2 on two different hosts if it can. I can still override that, but it will do its best to keep them on different hosts. We want to automate. We want to scale out. We want our jobs to be easier. We want to be able to do and implement changes faster. If you have to configure dynamic memory on 100 virtual machines, you want to do that quickly. We want to reduce human error, fat fingers. They cause a lot of mistakes. And we want predictable, producible results. This is exactly why I use PowerShell to do all my demos today. PowerShell is essential if you are working in IT. You guys are a skewed audience. You come to Tech Ed. Most of your hands were up. Those of you who didn't have your hands up, hopefully you saw why PowerShell is so valuable. A lot of people who will be watching this at home won't have the same opinion of PowerShell as you guys. They're still doubters or skeptics, or they think they don't have the time to learn PowerShell. I'll tell them what they don't have the time to. They don't have the time to not learn PowerShell. Because to be quite honest, if you don't learn PowerShell, you're capping your earning potential and you're limiting your career. In fact, you may not have a career for very long. All of the cool stuff I've shown you in Hyper-V today, PowerShell. The majority of it can only be done with PowerShell, and it only scales out if you implement PowerShell. If you're doing service management automation or SMA, if you're doing Azure orchestration, you're doing PowerShell. That's stuff that can actually save you money. Why have your virtual machines running 24 hours or 744 hours per month if you're using the calculator? Why not have them running for 300 hours per month and save about 60% of your Azure credit? PowerShell gives you automation, gives you scale up. Touch 100 virtual machines with a single PowerShell commandlet. No big effort. It makes life easier. It makes it predictable. And that's why I did that. I didn't want to be standing here. I did 10 demos in less than 75 minutes. I have 5 minutes left. I'm amazed. The guys were, people when they reviewed my session and looked at my session said, you'll never do this. You have 84 slides and 10 demos. You can't do that. You're going to run over. I did it because I used PowerShell. And I got the results I wanted when I ran the demos. No need to do any video recording and editing in one of those tools. There's way more I could have talked about today. I could easily have submitted a second session and said, I have a part two. And this is just a little sampler. Test VM network adapter, PA ping, do network diagnostics, even if you don't have connectivity to the virtual machine. Guest application monitoring so we can respond to a service failure within a highly available virtual machine and get the cluster to respond to move the virtual machine to another host, because that might be the cause. Deduplication of the storage for non-pooled or dedicated VDI virtual machines. Reduce the cost of your storage for those big VMs that are consuming loads of storage. Could be wasting it. Network convergence. I've already alluded to this. I don't need to buy some expensive network appliances to do convergence of networking. I can do that using Windows Server 2012 or later PowerShell. I can invest in those nice SMB3 capable NICs and use that not just for my storage, but also for live migration and cluster networking. And if I want, I can do other cool designs as well using network convergence. There's lots of them out there. You'll find them on my site, and you'll find them on TechNet as well. There's a lot of content this week. Some of the sessions that I'm highlighting here have already happened. Do what we all do. Download them when you're in the airport and watch them next week when you're supposed to be doing work in the office. I'll be flying to the US, so I've got 14 hours of time to kill on a plane, so I'll be watching lots of tech ed sessions. The sessions here by Ben and Patrick and Rob and Taylor, these are all really cool sessions looking at vNext. There's also a number of sessions looking at the current stuff, some by some of my MVP colleagues. Check them out. There's a lot of material there. You can find more stuff online on TechNet and on the Azure portal. Plenty of resources. Channel 9, obviously, is where you're going to find these sessions in the PowerPoint decks. And you learn more about Microsoft stuff on Microsoft Learning, on TechNet, and the MSDN network. Obviously, learn more about Azure. Get certified for half price. And please complete the feedback forms. I have loved the fact that I'm speaking at TechEd for the first time. I really appreciate so many people coming out to listen to me talk. The QR code is there. So please, if you did like this session, submit your feedback. And if you didn't, yeah, submit it anyway. I can't say not. So thank you for coming along to this session. I really appreciate you picking to come to this one and taking your time to come out this early in the morning. Have a great rest of TechEd. Enjoy the parties tonight, not too much. And hopefully see you in the hallways and at whatever Microsoft do next year. Thank you very much.